Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deity, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
I am a sound scientist, came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
It's June 22nd, and you're listening to the Humanist Hour podcast, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association. I'm Jess Constantine.
And I'm Todd Stiefel. Humanism is the life stance of being good without God. So listeners, we do have to give fair warning on this particular show because most of our shows are family friendly, but this particular show is family friendly depending on your definition thereof. There will be some explicit content. There will be some topics that may not be suitable for young children or repressed adults. So feel free to enjoy the show if sex is of interest to you, but if it is not, and or you have people around you that might not enjoy or appreciate the content, maybe you should listen to it later in the privacy of your own home with the lights dim, candles flickering, and some gentle Barry White music lingering in the background. And with that, I digress. So Jess, our guest this month is Daryl Ray, who has done a survey called Sex and Secularism, What Happens When You Leave Religion?
Listeners, I have to tell you, Todd, since he became co-host on The Humanist Hour, has been saying, Jess, I really want to talk about sex.
I so want to talk about sex. Does that mean I'm repressed? I actually don't think I'm repressed.
Todd, we said we weren't going to talk about our personal sex lives.
Yeah, we've got to have fun with this and talk about some things without getting to the point where our significant others get pissed at us. See, because I'm an open book. I could care less. I don't care what people know about my personal sex life or anything else. I'm more than happy to post it on the internet for the world to see to the point that they care. But my wife, on the other hand, who tends to typically participate in such activities, might not appreciate the publicity with which I portray my sexuality.
And I'm someone who's comfortable talking about sex, but not necessarily my own life.
So, can you tell us about your personal sex life, Jess?
Well, actually, Todd, I was thinking now that we got our listeners excited, pun intended, that we might switch gears just for a minute to talk about some stuff that's happening in the movement and then dive right in.
So if this is a sex episode, what should we refer to this opening segment as? For some people, it's nothing.
That's true.
Maybe we should just skip right to the heart of the matter.
That's awesome. No, I think that we should certainly prepare the way for our listeners. And let's give them a little foreplay. What do you say, Todd?
All right, a little foreplay. Things going on in atheism and humanism. So United Core, which is the United Coalition of Reason, unitedcore.org, for anybody who wants to check it out, got their bus ads rejected in Little Rock, Arkansas. Not, I guess, too shockingly.
In Arkansas's defense, the ad was going to say, are you good without God? Millions are. I mean, come on.
Yeah, exactly. So apparently they were planning on running a roughly $5,000 marketing campaign, and the city, I guess the Central Arkansas Transit Authority, rejected the ad campaign because they don't like non-theistic messages, even though they allow them for churches and faith groups and the like. So the Appignani Humanist Legal Center, which is part of the AHA, is donating legal services to United Core to help rectify the situation because they feel that it's a First Amendment violation for the government to allow religious speech on these buses, but not to allow non-religious speech, if you will, on the buses. My guess is the Appignani Humanist Legal Center is going to win this one pretty quickly, but you never know. You never know. It depends on what kind of judge you get and things like that.
Well, let's hope that that gets resolved, as we all know that it should. Todd, my news actually is good news. And it's about a movie that's coming out this month, this July, called The Ledge. And it's written and produced by Matthew Chapman, who happens to be Charles Darwin's great-great-grandson. And so one can guess that there is a theme of atheism in the movie. Some folks are saying that it has the potential to do for the atheist community what Brokeback Mountain did for the gay community. So I spoke with Matthew Chapman a few days ago, and he's going to tell us about the movie and also what our listeners can do to help the movie succeed.
We got a jumper. He's on the roof at the Tamlicher building.
Hey, how you doing? I'm Hollis.
You a cop?
Yes. You got you a girlfriend?
Not exactly.
This is Jana Harris, looking for a job, so be nice to her.
I'm Gavin. Hi.
My wife tells me you're her new boss.
You ever look around and the world just seems empty to you?
Oh, yeah.
Has it ever occurred to you that maybe it's because you don't have God in your life?
Please give us the strength to resist temptation, for sometimes we are sorely tried in this evil world.
It's always inexplicable why you fall in love, isn't it?
You have a very sexy mouth.
A very sexy married mouth.
I don't think I've ever loved anyone before you.
Hello?
Tonight around 8?
God, help me.
Lord, forgive this man.
All I can think about is you.
You don't have to do this.
Actually, I do.
I love you.
I was outside listening, and I thought of smashing down that door and killing you both.
You're not up here by choice, are you?
I have to stay up here until noon, and then jump. If I don't, someone else is gonna die.
If I say I'm gonna do something, you better believe I will. The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil.
Matthew Chapman, thank you so much for speaking with the Humanist Hour. So you have a project, you are a writer and director of the film The Ledge. Can you tell our listeners what that's about?
Well, it's the first kind of mainstream movie with an atheist, quote-unquote, hero in a drama that deals very much with the conflict between faith and non-faith. It stars Charlie Hunnam, who's in Sons of Anarchy, Liv Tyler, Terrence Howard, and Patrick Wilson.
Well, I have to say, I've been watching the trailers and clips on the website all morning, and it looks phenomenal. I can't wait to, I'm going to download it from Sundance for sure and watch it this weekend. Your tagline is one Christian, one atheist, one survivor. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes.
So that's, it's a thriller, and I wasn't expecting that from, we had a little write-up about your movie in our online newsletter, the Humanist Network News. And I watched it. I was like, oh my goodness, it's a thriller. It's just exciting. So can you just give our listeners a little bit of a teaser, like a little bit of a plot synopsis?
Well, it's about an atheist who starts to have an affair with the wife of a fundamentalist. And ultimately, the fundamentalist, who is a kind of somewhat sympathetic character, I think, you know, and that he's suffered a lot and he's found what enables him to survive through faith. But of course, faith being irrational tends to lead to irrational actions.
Right.
And when he sees what's happening and sees his wife who he's been taking care of and who has her own troubles, when he sees her desire to sort of break free, he suggests a test of faith or non-faith for the atheist, which involves his going up onto the ledge of a very tall building and having to jump by a particular time, or else someone else will die.
Wow.
So it's an exploration of whether you can do good things, including great sacrifice, without faith, without expectation of an afterlife, which, of course, I know that you can. And that's what it is. And it's a thriller that, you know, you can go and see without any interest in philosophy and still enjoy it as a thriller. And women like it a lot because there's a love story in there. And I have found after screenings, you know, went to Sundance. It was selected for Sundance in the US Dramatic Competition, which is the main competition at Sundance this year. So they have a number of screenings. And after one or two of these screenings, I had several women come up to me and say how inspiring they found Liv Tyler's performance, because she plays the wife of a very oppressive fundamentalist husband. And they had been in relationships like this and had escaped them. Wow. And we're kind of inspired by that aspect of it, which I hadn't expected. So I hadn't expected that. I hadn't thought about that, but I was very pleased that it happened.
Sure.
And it's doing very well. It's being released by IFC, which is a very interesting New York distributor. And they're releasing it in an almost reverse pattern to how most films are released. They're releasing it streaming online, then video on demand, and then theatrical on July 8th.
And so you said that's not the way that they usually release films?
No, usually it's you start with the theatrical, mm-hmm. then you go to video on demand, and then you can get it on iTunes.
Okay.
And this is sort of the reverse, which is kind of good news and bad news. I mean, the good news is that it means that it very quickly gets out to a lot of people who might not otherwise see it. Which I'm very glad about. You know, it's all over the country. Anyone, practically anywhere. Well, anyone in America can see it, either by streaming or video on demand. The bad news is that this puts a lot of pressure on the two screenings, one in Los Angeles and one in New York, that start on July 8th. If it does well in those two theaters, then it will open wide. And I'm very much hoping that'll happen, because I think that while I'm very happy to be in New York and Los Angeles, they're actually the cities that least need to hear this message.
Right.
And it's not until a movie goes into a theater in a local community that it gets reviewed in the local newspaper that it causes controversy and debate and all the rest of it. So I think it's kind of, from my point of view, the thing I'm trying to do is to make sure that in those two theaters in New York and Los Angeles, they get filled up, they stay full. The opening weekend has to be very good. And then it will open wide and get to all the other places in America that would probably enjoy it more than people in New York and LA, because they're dealing with these issues in a much more personal and direct way than right. you do it in a big city.
Right. So I was just looking at your website, ledgemovie.com, and there are some things that our listeners can do to help support your movie and to increase the chances of that national release that you're talking about. Can you highlight some of those things that our listeners can do to help you?
Well, I mean, talk about it, blog about it, tell your friends to go and see it, post links. If you have Facebook, go on Facebook, post links to the website. You know, all of those kinds of things. It is worth visiting the ledgemovie.com. It's not the ledgemovie, it's ledgemovie.com. And look at the How to Help page, because, you know, this is kind of a moment where I think things are sort of loosening up. I mean, starting with Obama mentioning non-believers in his acceptance speech, then right. you have the Book of Mormon that is doing incredibly well and won 9 Tony Awards, clearly an atheist Broadway show. And now you have this movie, which could reach more than the Book of Mormon will.
Right.
This is a real opportunity for atheists. It's a mainstream, accessible, thrilling film, but it is clearly about atheism. There is a long debate in the middle of the movie where atheism gets its chance to speak about what it is. And it's really an opportunity. And I hope that people will support it and that it'll open doors for other secular directors, of whom I know many. So that's really it. It's a you know, it's a question of, are we going to be able to do as well as the Christians did for Passion of the Christ for this movie?
That's a great challenge to pose to our listeners. I like that.
Go to ledgemovie.com and look at what you can do and see the clips and download it, stream it. It's already been seen by, well, it's been, people have, 100,000 viewings have been ordered through Video On Demand, which means that probably 200,000 people have seen it already.
Right.
And these are non-atheists, most likely non-atheists, most of them. So it's reaching an audience that we don't normally reach in the atheist community, and reaching them in a kind of rather emotional way. And I sometimes think atheism can be a little dry. Mm-hmm. And this is not. This is a full-on drama.
I think it's just what our movement needs, is a way to make atheism more accessible to the general public. And this is certainly a way of doing that. So thank you so much, Matthew Chapman, for doing the work that you do. And for speaking with the Humanist Hour.
Thank you, Jess.
That was writer and director Matthew Chapman talking about his upcoming film, The Ledge. Learn more at ledgemovie.com. Listeners, don't forget, spread the word, tell your friends, download, stream the movie from sundancenow.com so that we can get the movie into as many theaters across the nation for its release date, July 8th. So moving right along, Todd, let's dive right into this month's content, which is sex and secularism. Our guest this month is Dr. Dale Ray, who is also an author of three books, two on organizational psychology, and his latest book is called The God Virus, How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture.
Exactly. He also has a new book coming out, Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality. And he has conducted this study along with Amanda Brown, who's an undergrad at Kansas University. And they hit a lot of people. I mean, usually when you see surveys, it's only a couple hundred people, but they hit 14,500 American secularists of various nomenclature.
Yeah, so the title of the study is Sex and Secularism, What Happens When You Leave Religion? And as Todd said, he did a survey of over 10,000 people about their sex lives, both while they were religious and then after they left that religion. So some pretty key findings. And also, I'm pretty interested in his whole reasoning for doing the study and why they've put so much effort into writing the report about their findings. I mean, they're doing this, you know, they're being legit. Like, it's getting peer-reviewed and they're having academics help them, you know, give their criticism and their feedback. And I'm pretty excited to have some hard data. So we recently spoke with Dr. A, and he was mentioning that part of his interest in this field is that religion, while they seem to be obsessed with sex, you know, from being anti-abortion and anti-homosexual and this whole idea of celibacy with priests and nuns and pedophilia, anti-masturbation, that they're trying to control sex, even though it's something that they don't ever talk about or want to educate their practitioners, their followers.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting and somewhat disturbing how this happens, because it seems to be a universal in religions where they do want to control sex and the message around sex. And I think it's because it's human nature. It's something we can't help. I find some of the Judeo-Christian religions particularly interesting because, like, for example, one of the Ten Commandments is you shall not covet your neighbor's wife or slaves or ass. I'm thinking that they meant donkey by that, but maybe they meant the wife's ass or the donkey's ass. I don't know. but they say that you shouldn't covet. And if you have any kind of lust for anybody who's not your married partner, then you've committed a sin. And the only way to get free of that sin is to join their religion and beg forgiveness and believe in their deity, etc., which, of course, is something that applies to everyone. Like, it right. means you, no matter who you are, no matter what you are, you instantly have sinned. Therefore, you're going to burn in hell unless you do this. So it's
interesting.
Right. Yeah. It's like, if you eat food, you are a sinner. But we can help you.
I travel a lot with, I go to conferences for fitness, and I also, my best friends are in a rock band. And so I talk to a lot of different people, and like, I'm flirtatious by nature.
Right.
And so I, I flirt with people also.
You haven't been flirting with me. Is this because of professionalism or...
That's correct.
Because you don't find me to be physically appealing in any sense. I mean, I understand I'm just a guy.
I still find men attractive. I'm just not attracted to them. But what I was trying to say is that sometimes I get crushes on people, and my partner knows that, and I think it makes our relationship stronger, because when I'm honest with myself and allow myself to feel, you know, attraction or, hey, I have a crush on that person, but yet I'm choosing not to act on it because I want to go home to my partner who I love and who I'm committed to.
Now, when you say crush, what do you mean? Is this a physical crush, an emotional crush, or both?
I think either or both. I think it depends on the person.
I totally understand. I get that. There's certainly, I mean, I'm happily married. Everything is great. We have great children. We have great sex and all that. And my wife's going to kick my ass for even saying that. But hey, honey, it's better than saying the sex is bad, right? So be glad it's good. But yeah, that's absolutely awesome. I find myself attracted to other women, of course. You know, I'm human. The difference is, I think it would be abnormal to not also be attracted to beautiful people. But the key is that I don't act on it.
Exactly. And not because it's against the law or because it's a sin, but just because it's ethical and moral, and it's what helps our families stay together and be sustainable and our communities last.
Yeah, I don't want to hurt her.
Right.
No, it would hurt her, so I wouldn't do that.
So anyway, this study is it's about finding out what happens to those folks who are growing up in their religion with all this control imposed on them or enforced upon them regarding sex or a lack thereof, sexuality. So what happens when they become secular? Well, let's find out. Here's Dr. Daryl Ray on the Humanist Hour. All right, listeners, we're here with Daryl Ray. So, Daryl, what would you like to talk about today?
Sex, my favorite topic.
Sweet.
Yes, I was hoping that you were going to say that.
We've been thinking about having all our listeners speak about it, whether they're qualified or not.
Okay. In January, I was doing some research for my next book, which is going to be called Sex and God, How Religion Distorts Sexuality. I'm building on what some of the chapters that I did in The God Virus, How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture, and some of the stuff I talk about in the God Virus is how religion creates guilt and why guilt is so important in religions, and particularly sexual guilt. And I talk in one chapter of the God Virus about the guilt cycle and how if you have to be taught what to be guilty of by your church. And then once you've learned that guilt, the only place you can get rid of the guilt is at that particular church. The guilt cycle always brings them back to their particular God Virus. So that was the basis of what I was looking at in the God Virus. And so I thought, you know, there's a lot more here that I need to explore. And part of writing the book and researching, I thought, I need to do a little empirical research. And so an associate of mine, Amanda Brown, and I put together a survey of 69 questions, and that was accidental. I want to emphasize that was accidental.
Mm-hmm.
69 questions that we were real interested in, that related to secularists. As far as we can tell, nobody has ever asked secularists about their sex lives. And that was what we did. And we have six hypotheses. Are you interested in hearing the hypotheses?
Please, absolutely.
Okay, six hypotheses. Hypothesis number one was religions use sexual guilt, and it's measurable. We can measure sexual guilt by religion. Nobody's ever done that before. Number two, people feel sexual guilt, the sexual guilt taught by their religion, but their actual sexual behavior does not change. Guilt may go up as a result of religious training, but behavior does not change. That was our hypothesis. Three, religiously conservative parents will be less effective at teaching their children about sex than more secular parents are. Number four, children raised in highly religious homes will receive poor sex education. Five, leaving religion, and this is a critical one, leaving religion has a positive impact on sexual satisfaction. And number six, religion would have a continuing negative consequence on individuals. So those are the six things we tested in this survey. We put the survey up. We tested the survey with some experts to refine the questions and all. And then we decided we'd put it up and try to collect 200 or 300 and do a final run to make sure that our questions made sense and all, which is just good research methodology. And I woke up the next morning and had 2,500 people taking it and more every minute. So I talked to a man and said, we can't stop this. We know it's probably still got some wording issues, but how do we stop it? It's gone viral. By the end of the week, it had 6,000. So then we sent an email out to PZ Myers the next Monday and said, you want to help us? And PZ put it up on his website, and we doubled our numbers overnight. 14,500 secularists participated. 10,000, almost 10,000 completed the full thing, which is a 68% completion rate, which is very good at survey research. So, but the data that we got in here has never been collected specifically on secularists. And that's the interesting thing. You know, you can look at the ARIS survey and the Pew survey and the religious surveys and the absence-only surveys. But of all that, you might, in the ARIS survey, you might find 500 people out of their 50,000 interviews that call themselves non-religious, let alone atheist or agnostic. So we've got the biggest number of people answering these questions that anybody's even dreamed of. But that's what makes it so exciting.
I was listening to your six hypotheses, and I noticed there's one missing, which is, did you ever hypothesize about what atheists say during sex? It's not God.
Oh, no, God. Oh, no, God.
That's all. I didn't know.
One thing we did, we were real careful about this, was we wanted to hear from people. We didn't want just numbers, you know, on a scale of 1 to 10 or yes and no. So on a lot of the questions, we'd ask the question, then we'd say, we'd give them plenty of opportunity to write written responses. We have thousands of pages of responses.
Wow.
We were blown away by how much people wrote to us. It was like, nobody's asked us this, and we're going to tell you everything. So somewhere in those thousands of pages, which we have not had time to analyze yet, they probably have tell us what they've said during sex.
I'm sure.
I'm curious how you measured these various things. So like question one, are any of these measured in inches, I guess is one question.
God, let's hope for your sake that they're not.
I am not going to get in the middle of that.
Well, I can say that because I'm a woman. I have nothing to lose with that one.
I don't mind. Fair.
Okay. What there's two components to the research. And the first component is just the demographics. Who are these people? And this material, the early part that I can talk about, has real consequences for who our market is. Who are the people coming into atheism? We didn't intend to find that out. That wasn't one of our hypotheses. But, you know, when you collect demographic data, you get stuff you don't expect. We now know where people are coming in to atheism from. And I don't think anybody knew that before, because we have checked all the other references. We've checked all the other surveys. And, in fact, if I ask you to guess, tell me where people are coming, I'll guarantee you, well, 80% to 90% of the people guess wrong. They guess the wrong spot.
Where are they coming from in terms of what, before we guess?
Religion. What religion is feeding atheism the most?
Catholicism.
Okay. That's a guess. I'm not saying yes or no yet.
Judaism.
Okay. Both of you are wrong. Catholicism is a darn good guess, but what we found was Christian non-denominational is feeding atheism bigger than even Catholicism is.
Wow.
Christian non-denominational is somewhere in the 28% range of new atheists, 5 years or less, are coming from Christian non-denominational. If they were six years or more, Catholicism.
Hmm.
Catholicism was feeding atheism 6 years ago. Christian non-denominational is now. Now, if you think about it, Christian non-denominational hardly existed in 1990. It shot up like a rocket with all these huge mega churches. And now it's starting to come back down. I mean, research is showing those churches are no longer growing as fast, if at all, and they're dying. So where are those people going? They're not going back to being Episcopalians, and they're not going back to being Methodists. They're moving to the next step, which is non-theists. No, every person I have, and I've talked to experts about this, not one person guessed Christian non-denominational. 8% of the U.S. population considers themselves Christian non-denominational. But yet they are accounting for 4.1% of all people who said they have been secular 5 years or less.
Really?
Whereas Catholics say 22.6%. Now, they're not far behind, so your guess wasn't too far off. But who would have guessed?
Right.
Now, if you go to Judaism, other people have guessed Unitarians. They're so far down the list, they hardly show up.
What about people who have been secular for longer than 5 years?
Good question.
Lifers, if you will.
We ask the same question. If you've been secular for 6 years or more, and that includes a lot of lifers, then 21.1% were Catholic, 19.8% have been atheist their whole life. Now, we define that in our survey as you've been atheist at least since adolescence. If they answered that question, then they get included in the atheist piece here. Next is Christian non-denominational at 13%. So you can see in the last 5 years, Christian non-denominational has jumped from 13% up to 24.1%. That's a huge jump. What does that tell us as leaders in the secular community about where our market is? I mean, there's some interesting possibilities here that we should be thinking about. Unitarian Church is not the place to look for new atheists. And actually, I've had a number of people guess Unitarians and said, nope, that's not it. Now, the most of this is preliminary data. The most important and most interesting of all the graphs is we looked at guilt. We said, how guilty was your religious training? How much was there guilt in your religious training from childhood? And people could rate it from a scale of 1 to 10. So we just put it on here and we said, you know, and we also asked what denomination were you raised in. So we've got this graph, and the minute I put this into the spreadsheet and printed out the graph, I looked at it and I said, oh, crap, people are going to think I faked this data. It looks just too pretty. It's just too great. Guilt. I'm gonna have you guess. Todd, stop looking here. What's the number one most guilt-focused religion?
Catholic guilt is...
Interesting.
Totally.
Right. And a lot of people do guess Catholic. Catholic falls in the upper 40%. But number one most guilty religion in the United States, according to our survey, is Mormonism.
Oh.
Number two is Jehovah's Witnesses. Number three is Pentecostalism. And number four is Seventh-day Adventist. Now, I say those four because if you look at this graph, and hopefully your listeners will download the report and look at it, these are four clearly more guilty than the rest. And they look cult-like, don't they? I mean, if you think about it, they're scoring way above everybody else in guilt. So that tells us they're doing something different. They're teaching guilt much better than the others are. And then if you go to the other end of the spectrum, what's the least guilty of all the religions? We get Unitarians have the least guilt. Isn't that interesting? And Jews, agnostics, and atheists, they're all in the bottom four, and they are clearly four below everybody else. We got four above and four below. Like I said, it looks like I faked the data, but yeah. I didn't. I just plugged it in, and that's what came out. We got small numbers of like Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims, so we need to interpret that with some care. We couldn't control who took the survey, so what we found out is 20% of the people came from outside the United States. We were concerned that might pollute our data a little bit. So we looked at the religiosity of people international versus U.S., and what we found was people who filled out the survey from international were generally raised in less guilt-focused homes than U.S. people answering the survey. So that tells us they're not going to pollute, so to speak, pollute our data. If anything, you're going to water our data down. That was good news. Mm-hmm. The comments we got from people, they're so interesting, and there's... in many ways, just heartbreaking sometimes. I'll read one here to you. Did your parents ever berate you for masturbating? And one person says, I still did it, but it was extremely embarrassed, and I felt I was sinning. I constantly felt like I was a bad person for having those feelings and desires. Another one said, being caught masturbating caused me to be beaten until I couldn't stand up.
Wow.
Yeah. I mean, that's the kind... I used to masturbate, then perform the Islamic ritual of cleansing and beg Allah for forgiveness. I tried to stop, but my sexual desire was worse when I didn't than when I did. I worried not only about sin, but also about the fact that my mother told me that if I masturbated, I would have problems with my future husband.
Oh, my goodness.
Over and over again, we get these kind of comments. And I mean, not a few comments, hundreds, thousands.
You know, it's interesting because I can't help but wonder if guilt is just a natural emotion that occurs when people's kind of inborn conscience is violated, where we kind of know right from wrong, right from birth, and we know when we're hurting other people, when we know when we're hurting ourselves, and the brain has evolved an emotional response, which we know is guilt, and perhaps the religions are just harnessing that guilt as a way of controlling people, as a way of forcing them to find salvation or absolve them of their sins. And they say, oh, well, of course you feel guilty because you broke this covenant or this dogma, when in reality, people might feel guilty for other reasons that are totally natural, or they might feel guilty because they've been taught something and their morality has been artificially altered by the religion itself.
I think you're probably onto something there, Todd. I definitely think it's about religions taking advantage of guilt, of human nature, of our conscience, whatever you want to call it. And they're doing it from a very young age. And I'm willing to bet that Dr. Ray here has a part of his study that has to do with age and religion and sexual activity. Don't you, Dr. Ray?
We ask about this first onset of sexual behavior, masturbation, petting, oral sex, and intercourse. And then we look by age and by religiosity. And in this part of our study, we took those people who rated their homes, their childhood homes, as a 1, 2, or 3 in religiosity and guilt. And
on what scale?
On a 10-point scale. And then 8, 9, or 10 on religiosity and guilt. So we were able to take, and there's thousands of people. I mean, with 14,500 people participating and 10,000 completing it, we have a lot of data. So we can ignore the middle and still have thousands of people. And that's what we did. We kind of ignored the middle, just looked at the outer edges, which are, I think, around 4,000 or 5,000 people. In that. So contrasting that, we look at religious versus non-religious at 15 years of age, and there's virtually no difference between when they started masturbating, none whatsoever. There's no difference between in petting. There's almost no difference in oral sex or in intercourse. And people did report oral sex and intercourse at 15 years of age in our survey. So then we move to the next level, which is 18 years of age. Here we see no difference in masturbation, no difference in petting, but in oral sex and in sexual, genital intercourse, which included female-female and male-male. We included all that. There's a slight difference. It looks like maybe a 6% difference between the religious kids doing it and non-religious kids. Well, the abstinence-only research shows in the United States, which has cost us millions of dollars in taxpayer money, shows that if you take an abstinence-only course, it slows you down by about 4 or 5 months, but you're still going to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, in our research, it looks like it slowed them down a little bit. By 21 years old, they have caught up. All the religious kids are masturbating, petting, having oral sex, and having regular sex at an equal rate to the religious kids. So religiosity, in our research, has a tiny effect on behavior, and in the millions of dollars they spent on abstinence-only research does the same thing. It has a tiny effect on behavior that lasts about 4 or 5 months. Your tax dollars at work.
That's awesome.
Wow, that's incredible.
Isn't it?
Was that 6% statistically significant?
If it's statistically significant that abstinence-only or religious training slows people down sexually, the other side of the coin is they're having sex sooner or later, and they're doing it without protection, without knowledge of what they're doing. Hence, you get higher STDs and more pregnancies among religious kids. And that's what the abstinence-only research is showing. The more religious you are, the more likely you are to get pregnant.
You know, I was raised secularly, and my family was never very open about sex. I kind of still had the fear of it as a teenager practicing celibacy. I never would have sex with my boyfriends in high school because I was not worried that I was going to go to hell and that was a sin. I was worried that I was going to get pregnant.
a very rational fear.
Absolutely. I was just like, if I'm not ready to be a mother, then I don't think I should be having sex.
Maybe if we taught more kids that, we'd have lower teen pregnancy rates.
Well, I heard, I was with some friends the other day who, we all used to work for the YWCA, which used to be the Young Women's Christian Association, but now it's just the YWCA. So they work toward empowering women and eliminating racism. And so, you know, liberal folks like humanists. And one of them said, there's no excuse for teen pregnancy because there is a prevention method for before sex, for during sex, and for after sex. And I was like, wow, I never thought of it that way. It's like you have three chances to eliminate an unwanted teen or early pregnancy. There's birth control, there's condoms or a female contraceptive.
Or morning after pill.
Right, exactly.
So the next area is, where do kids get their sex education? And again, we're contrasting the most religious raised versus the least religious in their childhood home. And what we find is that around 70% they get their sex education from peers. No surprise there. The next thing, and this is the first surprise, one of the first surprises in our data, is the least religious children report that 42% they get their education from personal experience, going out and doing it in some way, shape, or form. The most religious people report 50%. So they're 8% higher. These are the most religious people in our survey, and they're reporting sex experience is where they're getting their information. Well, that's kind of interesting, I think. Next is the kids from the least religious homes report that 38% of their parents talked. They get information from their parents, 38%. The religious report, 13%. 13, that's huge. Now, 38% is nothing to brag about.
Right.
But 13% is horrendous. And these are parents who are complaining that they don't want the schools educating them and they don't want their kids going through sex education. But they're not giving it to them when they come home. And the abstinence-only research shows that parents who are religious simply don't talk to their kids. But yet they don't want anybody else talking to them either.
It's the guilt thing.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
The more guilty a parent is, the harder it is for them to talk about sex. And they probably have terrible sexual relations anyway or attitudes about it. How can they talk to their kids about it?
Right.
It's crazy. My son is 8 years old, and he's already figured this out.
Wow.
He actually figured it out at the age of 7. That last summer, he figured it out. I was reading to him some clips from The Magic of Reality, Richard Dawkins' upcoming book.
Mm-hmm.
And so in there is just the phrase human mating. And my son, who's seen some of like the Earth and Life movies from BBC, has seen what mating is. And he sees the phrase human mating. He's like, well, wait a minute, Dad, humans don't mate, do they? So, well, actually, they do. And
that's cool.
Also, you could see on his face the light bulb go off, like, oh. And I was like, so that's where babies come from, and that's how it works. And he starts saying, you know, he just like instant stream of conscious, totally figuring the whole concept out. And he's like, well, Dad, you know what the difference is between animals and humans as far as mating goes, right? I go, well, what's that, son? He goes, well, with animals, sometimes they sneak attack.
That's cool. That's cute. I think it's important to teach kids anatomy and science, and because then they'll have that information when they get all the sort of soft, emotional, feeling, hormone stuff. They have a context for it all.
And I don't, you know, at least for my kids, I don't want them to be naive about these things and other kids to even have power of knowledge over them. You know, I don't want them to be like, well, what does that word mean? Or I don't understand what that is. And then they get curious and there's kind of this forbidden fruit concept.
Right.
You know, I want them to have pretty solid knowledge. I don't want to hide things from them. If they have questions, I want them to maybe feel more than comfortable coming to me like, what does this word mean, Daddy?
Oh, right.
Yeah.
So Todd's kids, their lunch table is going to be packed with other kids who want to talk. So what's that? What'd you learn last night?
And that's the hard part, you know. So I try to answer their questions, and sometimes I'll tell them about things, be like, but look, you can't talk about this. And I think, you know, at school, because you'll get in trouble, other people are upset by this. And so far they've seemed to understand that. There's certain things they know not to talk about, and certain things they know is okay to talk about. And at least so far, we haven't had any issues with it. They seem to kind of censor themselves, or, you know, they seem to know that where the line is, which is bizarre because Daddy doesn't know where the line is. So, like, for example, we were at a Easter brunch, and not really a religious Easter brunch, but just because the food is really good and, you know.
Right.
We're all about bunnies laying eggs because they're good fertility symbols and their eggs are filled with goodies. And so my son was looking at the program and saying, oh, look, you know, the Easter egg hunt is outside the ballroom. What's the ballroom? What is that? And I couldn't help myself. I started, you know, I love telling jokes that adults will understand, but the kids won't understand. So I started kind of playing off of the AC/DC song about, you know, I've got big balls, he's got big balls, but we've got the biggest balls of them all. But I didn't go into the whole song. And I said, well, the ballroom is this room that we're in now. And they call it the ballroom because a big, huge party is sometimes also known as a ball. So, you know, this is called the ballroom because this is where they have big balls, very big balls. And I'm thinking I'm getting away with this. And the adults at the table are laughing. And my son just looks at me. He gets this little smile. And he goes, you know, Dad, balls has three different meanings.
That's awesome.
I was like, way to go. Not only did you realize that there was the opportunity to tell a dirty joke, but you implied it without actually saying anything dirty. That's perfect.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a smart kid.
Way to go.
All right, Dr. A, what's your next finding there?
All right. So now we kind of started looking at sex after religion. And we asked people, how's your sex life since you left religion? In fact, the subtitle of our report is What Happens When You Leave Religion? So in this next section, we looked at how people rated. If they rated a 5 on a scale of 1 to 10, then there was no change. So we could see people who said, yeah, I left my Unitarian church and there was no change. Or I left Judaism and no change. Or I left my Methodist church and no particular change. But 54.6% of the people said their sex life improved when they left religion. And by far the biggest put a 10 in improvement. You can't get better than a 10. And I don't have this about 35% said 10 was where their sex life improved to after they left religion.
I sense a billboard campaign. Want better sex? Become a humanist.
I'm thinking you're right. Now, there were 2.2% of the people that said their sex life got worse after they left religion. And we were very interested in those people. What makes sex worse after you leave religion? And like I said, we had lots of opportunity for people to comment. So we looked at the comments. And what we found, people said, when I told my wife I was an atheist, she stopped having sex with me.
That's awful.
I was having a great sex life when I was a Christian. I could find lots of Christian girls to screw. Now if I tell a Christian girl I'm an atheist, they won't have sex with me. We got that over and over again from the 2.2%. Isn't that wild? Christian girls will screw a Christian guy. They will not screw an atheist, though. Oh, go figure. But like one of our hypotheses was that sex life improves. And this is pretty big evidence that sex life improved, at least for these people.
You have to wonder why the sex improves dramatically after leaving religion. Is that directly related to the guilt factor, that the guilt around the sex disappears as it was artificially inserted, and once that's gone, you can enjoy it more?
Right.
I think it's very possible. I mean, as a teenage male, I always found it interesting when girls would say things like, oh, I'm waiting till marriage. You know, I'm saving myself. And I couldn't help but instantly feel that that was a religiously imposed viewpoint. It wasn't, you know, I'm waiting for the right man. I'm waiting for the man who wants to father my, you know, who's going to be the father of my children. I'm waiting for love. It typically was, I'm saving myself for marriage. And if I don't beforehand, I mean, if I do have sex beforehand, then I'm going to be, you know, that's horrible. That's a sin. And I'll have this guilt. And it's just, yeah, that's, I think that's clearly a religious aspect that's interfering with these girls and these boys having an enjoyable sex life. But on the other hand, maybe it is preventing teen pregnancy to a degree. So, which is probably why it originated in the first place. Although
right.
My guess is a lot of these things originate back in a time, you know, when life expectancy and marriage age was very different than it is today. I remember as a teenager thinking of this concept of save yourself for marriage and thinking, well, this concept developed hundreds, if not thousands of years ago, back when people got married at like sexual maturity. They were getting married and having kids at 13 and 14. So save yourself till marriage meant, you know, save yourself till you're 13 or 14 years old. It didn't mean, you know, save yourself till your late 20s and repress yourself and your sexuality the entire time. So I can't help but wonder if this thing's kind of become a little bastardized as people's average age of marriage has increased.
Well, there's a movie about a guy who was saving himself for marriage, and finally he was engaged to someone who walked out on him. So they never got married. And so then it was like from that point on, he was just looking for a girl to marry so that he could have sex with her. And that's just like, huh. So marriage as an excuse to have sex, like that's doesn't seem a good thing to promote to anyone, let alone, you know, religious youth practicing abstinence only.
I totally think that happens. I think there's people that have been brought up to save themselves till marriage who put more value on the concept of not having sex out of marriage than they do on the concept of marriage itself. So they end up, once their hormones take over, they'd rather get married to someone they might not even be appropriate for and then have sex with them, just kind of disparaging the whole concept of marriage itself than to have sex outside of marriage. So it actually ends up twisting the values around and I think defiling the whole concept of marriage itself.
And potentially leads to future sinning or law breaking with cheating on your spouse or getting a divorce.
Yep, exactly.
And to me, I mean, call me crazy, but I think You're that crazy. I want to marry someone. Thank you. I think that I want to marry someone that I'm sexually compatible with.
Absolutely. I think it's good to take the car for a test drive.
Yeah, absolutely. All right, Dr. A, what's next?
How has your sex life changed since you got out of religion by denomination? That's our next piece. So now we can look right down the list and say, which denominations do you improve the most? And it's no surprise that the religions that scored really high on guilt, people are also saying saying they improved their sex life the most. So number one improvement in sex life was Jehovah's Witnesses. Number two was Mennonites, but it was a fairly small sample. So I'm a little suspect. But number three was Mormon, and they were way up there on the guilt, and they're way up there on the improvement. And then Seventh-day Adventists. So we get in the same group of people, or same denominations. But there's pretty clear proof: you leave religion, your sex life improves. Now, at the bottom, if you've been a lifelong atheist, there's been no improvement because they didn't leave anything. So we come up to Unitarians, people who said they are no longer Unitarian, no improvement there either. So there's low guilt religions. You don't get an improvement in your sex life. Sorry, guys. If you're a Unitarian, stay Unitarian. You're not going to improve your sex life any better than you already do, probably. But get out of there quick if you're a Jehovah's Witness or a Mormon.
Do you have any data of religious versus non-religious people in terms of the frequency of sexual activity?
No, we didn't look at frequency. And remember, we're really not looking at religious, non-religious. We're looking at people who left religion.
Right.
And now we were aware of the criticism that we're not really looking at religious people because they're not anymore. So what we did was we really wanted to understand how committed these people were to religion when they were religious. And these people are very committed. They're going to church multiple times a week. They're Sunday school teachers. They're some ex-ministers. And if you look at the comments, you will say, I have read the Bible, and I've prayed, and I used to lead a prayer meeting. We get tons and tons of those comments from people who rate high in religiosity before they left. So we're pretty sure that these are people who are very sincere about their religiousness before they became secular. But it's still a criticism, and we realize, I don't know how you'd get religious people to compare to this. I mean, can you imagine a Baptist filling the survey out when it asks some of the questions that we asked? Yeah, they probably wouldn't.
Do you think they tell them that? Is there a book that ranks it? When, you know, in that sort of Religions of the World book, do they say, you're going to feel this guilty after having sex?
I can't help but think that there's an angle to be had here. As we teach the world and spread the message of humanism, and I'm not really one who cares about proselytizing or converting people, but am certainly one who wants to make sure that people who already are humanists realize that what humanism is, and expose the fence sitters to our messages so they realize there's alternatives to religion out there. I can't help but wonder if sex is one of those things that might be the turning point. If we could help educate people, hey, guess what? You know, you're on the fence, you're questioning, you're not sure. Well, you're going to have a lot better sex if you become a humanist.
You're also going to feel better afterwards.
Yes, it's going to be really, really good.
Your guilt's only going to be from your post-orgasmic cigarette, not from the actual act of sex. Okay, Dr. Ray, so is there anything else that you think our listeners would like to know about?
Oh, pornography was really interesting.
Settle down, Todd. Settle down.
We found that
70% my web browser.
70% of women use pornography. Over 92 or 93% of men use pornography. Now, men, if they're going to use pornography, are using it by 21 years of age, according to our survey. Women, if they're going to use pornography, are still climbing until 30 years of age. But if they're going to use pornography, they probably have used it by 30 years of age. After that, it plummets. But we know both groups are using pornography at very high rates. Women, however, are 2 years behind men in the onset of the use of pornography. And they never reach the 90%. They only reach the 70% level, if you will. The types of pornography: erotic novels for women, internet shorts for men. Internet shorts. There was clearly a difference in what pornography used. They were allowed to choose three different kinds. So we get pretty high numbers in for women on DVDs and films with a plot and just photographs. For men, it's internet shorts, photographs, and DVDs with a plot. And everything else drops pretty far down.
See, my wife has a book entitled something on the lines of Porn for Women.
Yeah.
But its contents are essentially photographs of really hot guys doing house chores.
Nice. I like your wife, Todd.
We compared first onset of use of pornography by religiosity, because religions are so much against pornography. And we looked at does religiosity slow your use or beginning of the use of pornography down? And no, it doesn't. I mean, people who are religious are a little bit behind the non-religious, but they catch up really quick. By 21 years of age, males, we looked at religiosity by sex, and males are fully caught up by 21 years of age. Another thing we found was 29% of our population is kinky and has a fetish. And that's been very interesting looking at, but I won't go into that here.
We'll have to have another show all about fetishes.
Well, Dr. A, thank you so much for speaking with the Humanist Hour.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate that.
Oh, I've been the girl wearing the world, but it's over. I finally see it's not all on me. It's like my favorite sweater. Oh, but freedom looks better on me. So I won't be.
That was an interview with Dr. Daryl Ray, author of The God Virus: How Religion Infects Our Lives and Culture. You can learn more about Daryl Ray from his website, recoveringreligionists.com. You can also purchase his book from thegodvirus.net. Look for links to both of these websites from the show notes page of this episode at thehumanisthour.org. So while you're on our show notes page, learning more about our guest in sex and secularism, and don't forget Matthew Chapman's movie, The Ledge, you can subscribe to our podcast both on iTunes and via RSS.
You can also look at show notes and download previous episodes.
For those weeks in between our podcast, you can still keep in touch with the humanist movement by reading the Humanist Network News, which is the weekly e-zine by the American Humanist Association. Learn more at AmericanHumanist.com. www.hnn.org/hnn.
Listeners, feel free to call into our listener comment line and share anything you think would be particularly interesting. You could share your experiences on your experience with sex, if you will, before and after being religious, and anything else you think might be particularly interesting. And of course, any kind of listener comments that come in through our Google line are potential candidates for our Google Garbles section. So
That's right.
If you want to hear Google butcher your story about sexuality or sex life, feel free to do so. And but we must know, next month will not be an explicit episode, so try to keep it relatively clean so we can air it on a family-friendly.
Nice. So that number, Todd, is 202-618-1371. Listeners, we would love to hear from you. And also, new this month, you can like us on Facebook. So visit the Humanist Hour podcast on Facebook. Just search for us in your little search bar. Because we're so brand new, we don't yet have enough people to have our own facebook.com/thehumanisthour. So our goal is that by August, we're going to have a friendly URL to issue out to folks.
Yeah, go like us, folks. It's brand new. We only have a few likes. So like us and share it with your friends, please.
Folks, thank you so much for listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Jess Constantine.
And I'm Todd Stiefel. Jess, maybe we should have called this month's episode The Humanist Minute in honor of it being about sex.
Well, Todd, I was actually going to say that I was impressed by your stamina.
I get that a lot.
I'm sure you do.